Welcome to the Elite Form Podcast, episode number 8, Dave Van Dyke, Rutgers University. Dave and I were able to sit down when he came to town with men's basketball as Rutgers played Nebraska, and had largely a bit more abstract conceptual conversation around subjects, topics inside of SNC. I think it's fair to say that at a minimum we may have started an existentialist book club, but generally just had a great time. So, without further ado, Dave Van Dyke.
19 on his the personality class.
Okay.
On YouTube, because like to me that's where it is, and like that's where I always joke that to do my job I need to have a psychology degree, a business degree, and an exercise science degree.
I don't know if that's a joke, but
it's a joke, sure. But it's true.
Right.
So like, I've taught myself enough to be a dangerous businessman, but I've also like tried to figure out the psychology of motivation and like personality. Like why? Because like all of the tech that we measure, all this shit with, can't measure the human well. It's like whatever your motivations are, like whatever your mistakes that are involved, are going to dictate your effort. So if you can figure out a way to teach athletes who don't quite have the same drive, or pick and choose when that drive exists, how to channel it, or to create it, or to manufacture it, I guess is the best way to put it. Like that'd be more like that is more, I think, is more impactful for performance than anything I can do away with. Because then it's going to affect that. The motivation, like the intent, is there.
You and I share. We didn't know this, but share a mindset on this because. I'll pin a few things together. So the NAPL used to host these symposiums.
Mm-hmm. What's the NAPL?
Nebraska Athletic Performance Lab. So where Emma took you.
Yep.
And Chris Bach, head of the NAPL, did like a roundtable discussion of various tech providers. And so someone asked me, and I can't remember who, but like sort of what should be next. And my comment, even though we measure things in your weight room, was cognitive will be the next big step.
Yeah.
And I kind of launched into probably this ill-advised, like, the brain is the most complicated thing we know of in the universe, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, absolutely, motivation is just a small aspect of everything that feeds into what's happening before they even walk into your room, or our silly 3D cameras even see what they're doing. So absolutely. So I'll explain this real quick. You have full rights to say no. One of the things we started doing is, this is Malort.
Mm-hmm.
It's a liqueur you can only find in Chicago. And Johnny, a couple of years ago, dubbed it as the official drink of Elite Form. The official, unofficial drink of Elite Form. It's bitter.
Mm-hmm.
I often joke, just like our souls, whatever. So at some point, we tend to offer a toast in these things. If you're up for it, great. If you're not, no big deal.
Nah.
Because like Luke Bradford was like, I probably shouldn't do that. Everybody else has been in. Yeah. We'll come back to it later. Let you think about it. But so between Weinstein, Jordan Peterson, et cetera, I can see where it might be the case that you might have an opinion or two that
like you're
is unpopular. That's how you put it.
And I just think that, my opinion is that we're every year I do on ESPN game, they usually do something about strength coaches. And, at the risk of being counterproductive to my own best interests, I think that our importance can be overblown. I think largely overblown. I think that there are a lot of strength coaches who hinder their athletes in their development and performance as much as they help. And I think that sometimes being a strength coach is somewhat like being a parent. The best thing you can do sometimes is not get in the way. It's like they're here for a reason. Don't fuck them up. It's really like I started thinking that back when I was a GA at Penn State. I'm just like, You just need better athletes. Like, that's what you need. You don't, like, how much of an increase are you going to have in some of these things are really going to translate to being able to play better? Because, you know, there, like, I know basketball players who don't move well. Don't move fast. But are able to anticipate and think and play chess to everybody else's checkers, so they don't have to work as hard. Like, the best racquetball player I've ever seen was one of my professors at Penn State, and he never moved. He didn't have to move because he was, you know, like, he knew how to hit the ball and make you move around. So maybe there's a finite amount of change that we can impact, and again, I get this unpopular opinion, and maybe I'm just not a good strength coach. Maybe I'm just, like, because I've seen my athletes go, and especially basketball players, and maybe football's different. Maybe they're, like, a lot of sports are different, but I've seen my athletes go and play overseas, not really not touch many weights, just play, and maybe exercise now and again, doing some whatever, and play better. So what did I do? Did I really help them? I mean, there's a lot of other things that I can, you know, justify why they played better. You know, it was money on the line, you know, their livelihood, you know, how they were feeding themselves. So they had more at stake. Okay. They still look good. I mean, aesthetically, they didn't look any. I mean, they looked smaller, but they jumped, like, you watch them play, it's like, wow, they're playing really well. Looks really good. Did he need to be able to sumo deadlift 725 pounds? And I'm to the point right now where, like, I know they don't. Now, I think there's certain thresholds and certain minimums that we probably need to get to for certain guys. And I don't know what those are. I don't know what those hard lines or those hard baselines are, but been around long enough to kind of see it. And, like, know that I got a couple guys who, they're not going to, their max on RP squats never going to go up from where it's at right now. But I go down. I'm fine with that because they don't need to get any stronger. Like, I don't need them to be able to grind out that way. I just need them to stay healthy and figure out what's the next thing besides strength that's limiting their ability to play.
And so then, like, sometimes that's going to fall under what your jurisdiction, if you will, like what you're doing. Like, it could be a physical component.
Mm-hmm.
But how are you guys set up if that, whatever that next thing is, like, isn't in terms kind of for you to deal with? Like, you just have a conversation as a staff?
Yeah, we're not really set up for it. Again, that's why, like, you know, I have a YouTube psychology degree. I have conversations with the coach, try and give him my input on, like, maybe where his head's at, where his motivation may be, and what we can do to try and steer that in a different direction. But
see, I think you do yourself a disservice, and I mean that with a smile. No, see this, the smile on my face. Like, I am showing my age when I say I used to just say I have a library card degree. So yeah. Same sort of thing, right? Yeah. So yeah, I go check out these books. There's, like, a Good Will Hunting joke in there somewhere, too, right? But I try to be well-read. I don't have a degree, right? But that doesn't mean you can't speak intelligently to the subject.
Yeah, you know. So. I have enough knowledge to be dangerous, to a certain respect. But I know that, so at least I try not to be dangerous.
Well, but you're presenting it in that way. Yeah. It's not like you're saying, hey, I'm the same as someone who has this PhD. No. It's more like, hey, based on what I've read, I'm seeing these things. And then you can let them agree or disagree with you. And if you're right, it's great for the kid.
Mm-hmm.
So away we go.
Yeah.
It seems all right. YouTube, library cards.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Right. Well, half the time it is the same thing. Somebody reading on a video. But so I'm going to, if you don't mind, back you up a half step and just talk a little bit about I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, before you went to Rutgers, you were at Stony Brook?
Yes.
And how long were you at Stony Brook?
I was at Stony Brook for 12 years. 04 to
2012. So that's a solid amount of time. Yeah. So what was that transition like then, moving to a larger school like Rutgers? Because that comes up a lot with, like, staff we talk to. Mm-hmm. You get into a resource conversation. You get into a student athlete kind of population conversation.
I think there's a lot of differences. It's like it's across the board. I think, you know, when I left Stony Brook, I thought I had a pretty good handle on how to run a department. You know, looking back, after my thoughts in that first year, after being there for 4 years, like I knew how to run things at Stony Brook. I didn't know how to run things. Like what I did there wasn't. I couldn't systematize it as well, because a lot of the growth that occurred there was because of me, and not because of me, but like I was a part of. So like the people that I had around me, I had had great assistants. So like we grew together. And so it wasn't me teaching them what to do. It was us learning together how to work, how to operate. And so coming in and trying to establish a department was different, because there was already things in place. So I thought I had an idea like what I wanted to do, and like with the resources that I had and like the structure that we have, and look at all the org chart projections that I put together and kind of laugh about what we were, what I thought would be the best way to go, and what is now. But I'm willing to admit that I'm wrong a lot, and okay, well, that didn't work, but what can we do? And sort of be fluid with it. I think that where we're at now with the organizational structure is better than what we were. But there's still some things that need to improve. But,
now, are you referring to Rutgers now when you say
yes,
that?
Yes, for Rutgers. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Like where I'm at, like what we're doing now, like the structure that we have, and like in terms of like my department specifically, like we made some changes, and Glenn and Frank have been tremendous. They've been awesome, and like I love my staff, but it's still like I want to be better than that. I want to be better than just adequate. So
were those, when you talk about making structural changes,
mm-hmm.
was that a case of you adjusted based on the staff that you had? Was it sort of fitting into a Rutgers organizational structure?
A little bit of both. I think some of it was, like using the strengths of the staff that I had, and like, you got to coach the team that you have, not the team that you want. So, I used to, call my brother all the time and say, I don't like this guy, I don't like that guy, or need to change this, need to change that. I was like, well, they're yours, so you got to do something with them. Because, like, if you get rid of them, then, like, who are you going to replace them with? So you got who you got. So aside from firing everybody, and if it's not worth firing everybody, then like figure out how to make them better. And so I think that's what I tried to figure out ways for me to be able to communicate what I wanted better, and like what my standards were, what I thought, how things should be done. And I was willing to negotiate some of those things.
Pardon me for not knowing this. Is your brother that you referenced talking to? Older brother in strength conditioning, he was speaking from just a fundamentals.
He does a lot. People. Yeah, he does. He works in management. So
okay.
So he's
a fastball down the middle for him.
Yeah, he knows how to do it. Like he has to deal with this a lot. So he's like this, and he was in the military too. He's like, you got who you got. Like you can't get rid of him. But you got to deal with who you got. So yeah, so I just try to be better for them so that they knew what my expectations were, and try and be more specific about what my expectations were and what I wanted and what I valued. So some of my methods were more effective than others. So
what's been effective?
Listening more, asking for other opinion. Like I think whenever you can get people to agree to their own enslavement, so to speak. Like if you're going to be a slave to something, like might as well define what you can decide what you're going to be a slave to, wouldn't that be better than being told what you're going to be a slave to? So if they have to hold themselves to a standard, why not make it what they want? And like maybe guide them towards what, you know, have some non-negotiables in terms of what my expectations are. But, you know, if you want the rack set up a different way than what I had it, fine. Go ahead. Like, it's got to look tidy. It's got to look organized. Like, can we all kind of agree what organized looks like so that there can't be six green bands on one and none on another? That's disorganized. There should have to be some order to it. There's, you know, I'm very high in orderliness, so I want to see order. And I think that, like, translates, and I also try and keep in mind, like, you know, the athletic department's put a lot of money in these facilities. And they'll bring people through and show, this is what we do with your money. And if we make it look like a shithole,
right,
why would they want to invest money when all they're going to do is see it turn into, you know, a dump in a couple of years? So I think that's one of the things I try at least mention to myself so that they understand that, you know, it's not just me being a Nazi about orderliness, but there's something to it. And there's like a sense of pride. Like it's, you know, if there's already a piece of tape on the floor, you know, the guy's not going to think twice about throwing his tape on the floor because there's one already there. It's not like I'm not the only one to do it.
Yeah, it becomes the way things are done.
Yeah.
Snowball effect.
So, yeah, I think being, you know, just like in like effective strategies for dealing with athletes, be a decent human being. Just be like, don't yell, don't raise your voice. Like, you can be passionate without being being attacking. So that's what I tried. I've tried to grow towards.
Well, that last one is an area I need to grow on because I usually throw out a reaction. I usually think it's a reasonably well thought out reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But the language I use is occasionally not the kindest, right?
Yeah.
So I may lead with, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And then I'll back it up. But I've already thrown out the, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard, which, depending on who hears that, the rest of the rationale may become totally meaningless. So,
yeah.
So if you have any tips on that one, I'm all ears.
I try and, I think silence is sometimes the best thing to say.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, because you can't take it back. Once it's out, it's out there. You know, it's just like any relationship, you know, say something not nice to your wife, it's going to take a lot of time to rebuild that. You know, once it's out there, once you've said it, like, don't say it if you don't mean it. And if you're saying you didn't mean it, then what's your word worth? So you'd rather be, you know, be very careful with the words you use.
It's not just words, but tone too. Yeah.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm a violator of tone quite a bit.
Yeah. I try and be as not monotone, but as I'm usually not good at it. I try and be as even as I can.
Hand raised on this side too.
Yeah. So.
Well, you'll appreciate this because you mentioned Weinstein. So I also will listen to the Sam Harris podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife knows that I listen to those, and she knows that I have a philosophy degree and all those things, right? And every once in a while, she'll just want to shut me down. And it might be something political, right? It could be any subject, but she'll go, hey, I cannot be on a Sam Harris podcast.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you know that feeling.
Yeah. My wife just usually does the, oh, I'm sorry, were you talking? So, like, goes to sleep on me, but I get it. No. I have a tendency to drone on and not land the plane, like keep circling.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We can just talk about this till it's totally in the ground.
Yeah.
And then I'm probably going to talk about it for five more minutes.
Still got something to say. Still like part of my opinion that wasn't quite expressed.
Oh, exactly. That's funny. So one of the things that I was going to bring up is in the new room, well, and even previous to the new room, basically, you just have access to a fair amount of technology.
Yes.
And at least on this podcast, I never want anything to be a spiel, right? So I talk about, HRV as opposed to particular products or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not that I care about mentioning them, but Do you mind walking folks through the tech that you have access to?
Sure.
And maybe a little bit about how to use it?
So I'll start with what I use directly. So with men's basketball, we wear Strive shorts. So it was like an EMG picture of what they're, you know, an EMG reading when they're working. So you get an internal load. It's not directly linked to heart rate. It does like an external load via like some indirect measures, but I use Connexon to get positional data with my guys. So, you know, where they're on the court, speed, distance, those sorts of metrics and time. I use Connexon. We have Sparta Science for all of our sports. So every sport is in the system. Everybody uses it to their own degrees. The standard is that we want to be having every team scan every about 3 weeks.
Okay.
We do an okay job with that. I think that we can do a better job, but part of it is just the logistics of it. We also, with men's and women's soccer and women's lacrosse, they use Polar, Team Pro. Women's soccer uses it probably the most extensively. Women's basketball uses Strive as both their internal and external load management. We have Elite Form in all the racks at the APC. We have Gymaware at the Rodkin. It's not the Rodkin, the Druskin weight room over at the rack. We use FreeLap, which I think is great. It's a great tool. What else?
I think that's about it. In terms of the use of those, is that sort of driven in collaboration with the individual sport coaches, or how does that kind of conversation function at Rutgers?
I mean, who's like the driving force behind it?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, so you mentioned, I think you mentioned women's soccer uses the Polar stuff more extensively than others. Is that because there's a lot of buy-in?
Yeah. They have a lot of buy-in. I think they've had some success with it. They've been able to, they use it to substitute players. They use it to manage like extra work during the week for those athletes who, their training load scores below a certain amount. They worked very extensively with Sean Art when he was at Rutgers for a number of years. So they've been able to use it, get a pretty good handle on the data and know what some hard thresholds are for some of their metrics.
Gotcha.
And use that for planning practice throughout the week and also throughout the, training for the summer. So I think for them, it was a bit of Sean in the beginning because he was working with them before I got there and using the Polar before I got there. So I think a lot of it was with him but Mike saw, my coach O'Neill saw the value in it and, they've had a lot of success. So, within their system, it worked very well. I think with some of the other sports, they wear it. They don't really use it. Like they collect the data. Like the data is there.
They're to be used, right?
I think the next step for us would be helping them see the value in the data and collecting it the right way and being able to get valuable data or clean data, I guess is like to use a made up word, so that you can actually know that what you're looking at is what you're looking at, what you're looking at is what actually happened. Field hockey does a really good job with using the data. They meet weekly with the strength staff, and it's pretty much they started working with Sean a little bit, but wanted to move away from that. So we picked that up, and my one assistant did a great job in managing that relationship, and we had a former intern who's now gone is really good with Excel and made some spreadsheets that you basically just click, copy, paste, and puts it up.
People that are monsters at Excel are valuable.
Yeah, like I'm trying to get him a job so that he can, so I can somehow repay him for everything he's done for us. But yeah, David Keyes has done a tremendous job with those and helping us out. You know, obviously with men's basketball, like I have a great relationship with my coach. It's my 14th year with the guy, so I'm very, I think it's a very unique situation. So he knows his team very well. He knows, like, he's got a very good handle for what, like, how much you can get out of him, and knows that there's a finite amount of resources within the athlete to be able to practice. So he's going to use those, he's going to use those pretty wisely, and he's intuitively, he's got a pretty good handle on it. And like, really, he asked me, like, you know, how long should we go? And I know what he means by that. It was like, you know, interpret like what he wants, like, sure, how long should we go? And then give him, you know, I'm obviously there at every practice, so I know the drills, and I know where, like, I catalog all that within the systems. So I know, like, what, which drills are more game-like than others. Like, you know, me reading the matrix rather than me having an actual number of, like, what a game equivalent, what this drill is in game equivalent minutes. But being able to have that conversation, like, you know, let's do 5 and 10 half court today, and not do, or we should look to do maybe more 5 and 10 than doing any kind of full court transition. And, well, either, yeah, it sounds good, or, you know, tell me to go pound sand, and I don't take it personal. Because, again, at the end of the day, like, one of the things I try and impress on my staff is, like, this isn't my team. This isn't your team. It's their team. Like, if you look at a Wikipedia page for Coach Fico, it's, like, one of the, probably the first things you'll see on there is his record, his career record. He can't escape that. So the head coach is tied to that for the rest of his life. And his livelihood is tied to that. So you have to trust that they're going to make the decisions they think are best for their program to be successful. And it's in their best interest. I mean, that's their livelihood, especially at this level. Your job is tied to your success on the court, field, whatever it may be. So you've got to accept that, and accept that role as, you know, you may be the expert in your realm, but you're still an assistant. Like, you're their assistant, just like any of the assistants on the bench. He's going to tell them to shut up and sit down if he thinks we should be doing something other than that. If you want to make the decision to be the head coach. That's like, and I think that's, it took me a while to come around to that, because, like, you know, you get resentful because, you know, you give them the information, you give them the feedback, and why aren't they listening? Well, they, like, their coach's eyes tells them that they should be doing something else, and they've been successful at this point doing something else. So you got to find a way to, like, you're not going to convince them by telling them they're wrong. Maybe you got to agree with them when you don't really agree with them, and get them to trust you and develop the relationship so that you're able to be at a point where he'll listen or look at your conversation, the words that you're saying, as, yeah, maybe there's something to that. But it doesn't take, it's not overnight. And, like, you don't build credibility overnight. Like, just because you got, you know, degree, and, like, you've got to show value. You've got to show, like, you can add value to the organization. Some people are, like, I always, like, you know, you're not going to be treated like, I'm not treated like everybody. I don't expect to be treated like the president of the university, because I'm not. Okay, I'm an employee of the university, but I'm not the president of the university, so I don't get his parking spot. I don't get his pay. And I don't get his, all the benefits of being president, but also I don't get the responsibilities and duties associated with that. And you've got to be okay with that. And that's how the world works. And, you know, it's like, I laugh, like, you know, one of the favorite stories I've heard about, like, of, like, in the pros with, like, you know, Bill Belichick's obviously, you know, he's the mastermind. He's the, all this. And, you know, he told a story about how he was at the Giants, and he just had the linebackers and started a meeting, and Lawrence Taylor was late. And so they started, and I came in. So he went to Coach Parcells and said, you know, I just want to let you know LT was late today. Like, well, why'd you start the meeting without him? So you need to, like you got to figure out where the values are in the organization you work in, and align yourself If you're not, you're going to be unhappy.
Well, to steal it from something we were talking about earlier, like we mentioned Jordan Peterson, and he'll talk about hierarchies a lot, right?
Yeah.
And understanding anyone, really, is inside various hierarchies and understanding your place within them. You can add value and not be in the top spot. You can increase your value within the hierarchy.
Yeah.
But the nuances of getting to know that does take some time.
Right. And I think in his book, he has a quote, says something along the lines of, I texted it to the team, like, you know, the world presents itself to you by your values. What you value is how the world is going to present itself to you. So if the world isn't presenting itself the way that you like, maybe you should evaluate your values. Maybe what you hold most dear and as the most valuable is the one thing that's holding you back, is the one thing that's keeping you from being happy or being fulfilled. And that's like it's hard to wrap your head around, because it's like, you know, the things that you're like, I think human beings are like their own worst enemy sometimes. And, you know, I didn't like I always try and figure out, okay, well, I think something's a great idea. Okay, well, why can it be wrong? Like, how am I wrong in thinking that this is a good idea? And like, so you try and figure out, you know, steel man the opposing.
Yeah, absolutely.
The opposing position, and see why out and try and figure out all the ways or come to terms or I guess like see from the other person's perspective on where you're wrong, so to speak. But like, you know, people like being miserable. I think I really do. And like I started reading, you know, the tangent I was going in or the direction I was going on was I started like reading some of like Dostoevsky's.
Yeah.
Like listening to it. I can't. I just listen to it. I'll go on like a 10, 15 minute
walk. As someone who's read a few of those, listening's much better.
Yeah. Okay. Like I couldn't imagine trying to read, because some of those words I'd have to go back and read a couple times. Like he stated something along the lines of, you know, people are passionately and romantically involved with their own suffering. And like we define, like, you know, just like, and every strength coach, this should make sense, because like, what are you doing? Where you're like, is that like you say? It feels good, but in the moment, it's discomfort. In the moment, it's like having 700 pounds on your back does not feel great. It's not like it's not the same as foot massage, you know. So like, you're proud of that. What are you proud of? Some of yourself. I mean, but it's not saying that that's wrong. And, you know, I got a tattoo. I got two tattoos. One of them is a Bible verse. And it's Romans 5. It's we rejoice in our suffering, knowing that suffering produces character. Suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance, character, and character, hope. And I believe that. And that's, you know, it's, you know, sometimes you got to struggle, but, you know, sometimes you got to look at whether or not you're just, you know, some dumbass sitting on the corner banging his head with a hammer, saying, you know what, it feels so good when I stop.
I also wonder, along the same lines of thinking, think about how many people will comment that losing hurts worse than winning feels good.
Oh.
And there is this emotional tie to the suffering side of anything that does seem to dwarf in some ways.
Well, I think it depends. I agree that when you get to a higher level, like for me, like winning feels good, but it's like it should be the expectation. Like you want that to be your reality. You want that to be, you know, you don't get too excited when you win, because, you know, that's what we should do. I mean, nobody wants to lose, so you shouldn't be so excited when you win, because you prepared, you did all the work, you did put it. If you put in the time and effort, you should want to win. You should like that, to have the proper mind frame going into the game. That should be expected. So losing is disappointment, and disappointment is negative emotion, as far as I know. But I think we did lose a lot, not necessarily like on a consistent basis, but we played like three conference championship games in a row where we lost. So we could have gone. I think it was either Albany or Vermont went when we didn't. They went like three or four times, so we only ever went once. And it didn't feel as good when we did win it as it hurt when we didn't. Like, cause a couple of those losses were heart-wrenching. And that, like, Peter Hooley hits a, you know, right. Janelle taps it back. Hooley bangs a three with, like, 2.4 seconds left. And a couple other ones. But, like, those suck. Like, that sucked more than it felt good. I mean, granted, what happened after the win, like, in terms of my life, was a lot better than what it was after the losses. So, yeah. Right.
It's a well-rounded thing. Yeah, right? So,
like, in the moment, yeah, it was like, there was no one really, like, when I got back from, when we got back from the tournament, I got to hang out, like, with my now wife at the time, my fiance. I got to celebrate, and that felt good. That was awesome, because it was like, you know, the season's over, and, you know, all that. But, yeah, like, winning's good. Like, it's like, but yeah, losing's worse. Losing's twice as worse. And the thing about it, like that's, you know, like, well, like, Peter and some of Peterson's writings and his talks and everything else talks about, like, you know, motivation. Like, you need to have something to run away from, because you're gonna, as he says, or something along the lines of, you know, you can only feel so good, but hell is infinite. So sometimes it's not bad to have something that you like, have something bad that you can't allow to happen, because you're gonna work harder to get for that not to happen than for something to feel good, because you can only feel so good. Like, you know, ask a heroin addict, right?
Well, it circles back to, like, what we were saying when we first started talking about motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the number of ways people motivate themselves, like, completely dark,
mm-hmm.
right? Or in a very sort of positive, yeah. I don't want to say lovey-dovey, but I'm tempted yeah. to, sort of way. Like, there are guys we would have experienced that have giant chips on their shoulders.
Yeah,
and that just drives them. Yeah. yeah, drives them day to day. And then other people that somehow... I'm not one of these people, but manage to be super positive mm. all the time.
Yeah.
And they remain motivated. So when you figure that one out,
I wish
we'll be on to
yeah,
something.
If I do, I'll definitely have a book.
Well, that's why we can talk about Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
You know, ancient yeah. writers talking about the same
yeah.
the same subject. So no question. What's the last? Do you remember what the last Dostoevsky piece you listened to was?
I'm working on Tales from the Underground.
Okay.
It's a hard start, but finally got had a, like a long. I was driving back from Virginia and was able to listen to it for a while and like got into it, because it's just, and like if you, because again my YouTube degree, your library degree, like I was listening to somebody talking, like even like an overview of his work, and essentially like, you know, Tales from Underground, like the main character, like he's an asshole.
Like he's, oh, for sure.
He's like he's like the worst possible person. Like a kid. Like, it's like everything you hate about somebody, like you just don't want to be around. It's like I can't listen. Like I can't. It's like if I got into it, it's like okay. So I kind of like, and I had to read. Like I wanted to like sort of read. Like, what's the point of this book? This is just really like frustrating. It's annoying. Like his writing is that way. In that like Crime and Punishment was like. I got anxiety, like the way he wrote, the way it's sort of like, and right. the way it was read too helped. But I was like, what was like? You didn't know what was going to happen. Like, how was it going to turn out? Is it going to turn himself in? Is it not going to turn himself in? What's like all this stuff? He's like working through it. And it's like I was anxious about.
Oh
like,
yeah,
I was like,
that's what he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he was really good. And, like I didn't. I don't think I. I don't know. I probably need to re-listen to. What's the other one?
Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah. I just like, there was a lot going on in that book. There was like a lot of different tangents and everything else is hard to follow. So I was listening to a lot when I was doing mountain biking at the time. So I was wondering if I was really paying attention. So.
Yeah. I try to legitimize mm-hmm. the fact I got a philosophy degree. but I had this course in high school, amazingly enough, where we had to read Notes from Underground, Crime and Punishment, and a couple of basically other things that would lead you to existentialism.
Yeah.
And then one of the first things, like in some early college course, was the Brothers Karamazov. And idealistic to me, was just hooked, you know? Yeah. And I still kind of agree with a lot of the thought process, go back to those books. Yeah. So as soon as you brought that up, that's why I was like, hey. But the way they used to release those works, like when he was writing them, mm-hmm. was more like how things appear on Netflix now. In episodes. Yeah, okay. So he didn't write the whole book. So you could read, like, basically what is a chapter.
Yeah.
And I've got to think, particularly back then, that's a much easier way to consume that, because there's only so long you can concentrate on stuff like that.
And what was the other, one I listened to? Oh, Man's Search for Meaning. You listen to that a couple times.
Viktor Frankl?
Viktor Frankl, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
Logotherapy.
Yeah. Like
we're talking about motivation, because that the whole point of that is everyone had a thing in those concentration camps that kept them going, and it wasn't always God. It was sometimes family. Like, if I recall, someone had some esoteric thing.
Yeah.
It was kind of amazing that was the one thing.
Yeah.
But so I suppose if we could find for each student athlete their one thing.
It's funny because I've been trying to do have a sauna in our new facility. I mean, obviously, we have a huge cold tub. I hate the cold. And I hate being in a cold tub. And, I'm okay with, a sauna. But, obviously, wrestling coaches use it. And all the way there, just throwing water on, make it nice and hot. It's funny, how your mind works. Because, I'm in there with somebody else, and they're talking, BSing around. Being there 15 minutes, literally, I'm breaking a sweat, figuratively, not breaking a sweat. But I'll try and be in there by myself, and 10 minutes, I'm like, all right, staring at my watch and trying to, breathe. Just, all right, serious. The time takes forever, and you think you're tough. And I think I know I'm not. I don't know. Reading some of that, and reading the other book about Jocko talked about on one of his podcasts, the German police force that was in charge of rounding up and killing. It's 101 or something like that,
right?
And talking about ordinary people. That's the name of ordinary people. And how all these people are just, they weren't, young indoctrinated Nazis. They were just normal people who were told what to do. And, some of them did, opt out. And they were given the opportunity to opt out, and they did opt out. But a lot of people just went along with it. And some people loved it, And it's knowing that, that could be. And everybody says, I want to be me, I want to be me. It's sure. Sure, you know yourself that well, and I think to get on rant, I think that our lives are so easy. There's so much surplus. You don't have to be hungry. You don't have to build a garden. You don't have to weed. You don't have to tend a garden. You don't have to do any of that stuff. Just go out and store it. It's easy. I go on campus with my brothers. And we go hiking. It's funny, every once in a while, probably not the best podcast conversation, but you go to use the bathroom in a locker room, sure glad I'm not leaning up against a log trying to bury my poop in the woods. And it's kind of you remember how much nicer it is. When you just get a glass of water somewhere, I don't have to go pump it, I have to go to the stream, bag it, pump it. And then try and make it taste somewhat powerful.
Having
again
context for your situation.
Yeah, but I think it's easy to quit. It's easy not to care. There's so many other things you can care about. If you only have a certain amount, if you're, and I think that's sort of So I think some people do this, or I have to do this, or else everything's gonna fail, everything's gonna go to hell. I think a lot of people do that with things that don't matter. I gotta be skinny. I gotta, what I look like in a pair of jeans. you know, that sort of stuff. Like, we have the capability of doing it, but we do it for, like, all the wrong reasons. We don't know how to sort of leverage it for something to make a greater good. I think it's hard. I'm not good at it. I know that. But
well, it takes a sort of an added level of concentration. Like, if we were going to steal from existentialism, mm-hmm. again, we'd talk about, like, herd mentality.
Yeah.
Right? And breaking out of that just takes that. Some people do it easier than others, probably, but that extra step. So do you find that, like, you're sort of distilling down some of these thoughts in how you're trying to deal with student-athletes from time to time?
Every now and again, but, like, I think it's trying to find ways, if at all, to be able to pass along something that's short and quick, but these things aren't.
Right. Very true. That's...
Like, but if something happens, like, or there's a, like, teachable moment, so to speak, then, yeah, I'll try and say something. But it's like, you know, what are you going to do? Have a lecture series with the team? Talking about existentialism?
Very true.
Yeah. Like, it, yeah. So.
Yeah. That's where even, you know, I tried using that phrase, distilled down.
Yeah. And, I mean, you try and, like, try and put it in terms that they would care about. And... Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So you had mentioned you had a few things that you thought of you might want to chat about. What's on your list?
Like, everybody's worried about, like, doesn't want to be wrong. Nobody wants to be told what did, like, I was talking to him earlier, you know, whenever you try and introduce something or a different way of doing things, you're going to be met with resistance. And being able to navigate those conversations in a way where you're offering up a non-confrontational opinion, and that you're being, the way to put it, it's like you're able to be like give your opinion without being essentially, like, where you're like, where you're being very careful to make sure that you're not making them feel that you're wrong. What you've always been doing this is wrong, and this is what you should be doing, and this is why. Obviously, that approach is like, whatever you say after that is going to be felt on the face. Because nobody's going to, everybody has pride. Nobody wants to be told that they suck at their job and you're lucky that I'm here.
Even if they do suck at their job.
You're lucky that I'm here because I'm going to save you. Because, like, nobody thinks that. Nobody thinks, like, most people, like, even if you are, you know, modest about your abilities, like, you're going to have, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if you didn't think that it was the best way of doing it. Right? Am I wrong? So, like, if you, like, anytime you go in, like, to have a conversation with anybody about making any kind of change, unless they just have no clue what they're doing, like, you're going to receive some opposition. You've got to be able to be ready to read the person and how they're reacting to that so you can adjust what you're saying. Because maybe you got to tiptoe and use your kid gloves and maybe back off and, like, try and get to part of the conversation that you want to get today later because they're not going to listen.
Well, when you said, like, read the person, it made me think of that phrase, knowing your audience.
Yeah.
And it sounds like to some degree that's, yeah, that's a kind of part of what you're thinking of.
Yeah, like, I mean, you got to know, again, it's like, if you can figure out what people value, you'll be able to have a conversation with them. What are you, like, that's why I always, like, I don't think, like, you know, what, like, what I think of, like, you know talking, I was talking to some people and stuff about, like, progression through the field. And it's like, okay, where am I, like, I think about, like, I always try and internalize it to myself, like, where am I progressing? Like, do I want to be an AD? Like, I don't know. Like, you know, I used to talk to donors and all these people all the time. Like, I don't know, like, what those people think or want or like. Or I don't know if I want to know. But, like, that's, I think that, so, like, for me, like, to be able to speak to an AD, you've got to know what their value system is, not what they prioritize. Because then, if you can speak to some of the things that they value and they prioritize, then you can say, hey, these values are like mine. I like it. And I think... that's like that's how you make friends. It's like, people have similar interests and values, and that's like it sounds cliche, but it's all about relationships and figuring out how to I don't say manufacture the relationship, but if you're working, like, that's what you're doing. Like, if you want to be successful, you got to create those relationships. And part of that's like figuring out what makes this dude tick.
Right. Well, some cliches ring true because they are true.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they became cliches. Yeah. And so even if it's, and like in terms of like doing almost professional development, like with our crew, one of the things that we'll talk about is like, you don't have to become friends with every single person like that we work with, or that, you know, like yourself, who we end up working with kind of on an extended basis. But there's typically some common ground.
Yeah.
And just find those. Find those starting points. And they tend to build on themselves if you're open.
Right? Yeah. And I think you have to be open and you have to be willing to be vulnerable and be open to where a conversation may go. Because like I wouldn't consider myself a very personable person. Like, I don't like people. I'm not an extrovert. I'm very much an introvert. I'm going to be exhausted after this podcast because we're having to interact and talk. But it's about something that I like and I think about. But like, I'm going to be done talking until tomorrow. I'm just like, I don't talk this much. I usually, like, it's not me. Unless it's about something I'm passionate about, then I'll shut up. But I had to teach myself to be personal. I had to teach myself to learn how to shut up and not cut people off. I'm bad at that, and I hate it. It's the thing that, like, when I find myself doing that, I just want to bite my lip because, like, I know how much I hate that. It's like, if you don't care about what I say, then don't ask my opinion. That's like, or like when I'm talking to like an intern comes to me, I was like, listen, right, if you got all the answers, then why are we having this conversation? So I've had to teach myself how to do that. And like, I'm just very uncomfortable. I had always been very uncomfortable with it. And I think part of it is just, I became more confident in my abilities as a professional and as a person, but I've had to like throw myself in those positions or situations that I wasn't comfortable with and be okay with it for as long as I could. And then, you know, leave and be by myself.
For a while. I think you and I share several similar afflictions because like, well, like NSCA coaches coming up, right?
Oh, God.
And those things exhaust me to no end because I'm not really a small talker.
No.
And so I'm just beat by the end of it, right? And so I'll see coaches that we know and they'll be like, hey, do you want to go do this? And the honest answer is, well, not really, because I'm no offense to you. And I would love to hang out, but not right now, because I'm dead, just flat out dead. And then when we first had the idea of doing these podcasts, conceptually, I was like, this all makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to be the one to do them, but I'm the right person to do them.
Yeah.
And so there was probably 2 months of, hey, are we doing that? Like, I would look over, are we doing that? Like, I don't know, probably. And he would just very... Every known me quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Just gentle nudge, I think. And then I think the whole staff kind of did it. And then they just knew they needed to wait on me to get good with it.
Yeah.
And it is sort of this weird, almost a paradox where it's like, I love talking shop.
Mm-hmm.
I'd prefer to talk shop with just a couple of people at a time. And yet, even though I enjoy it, when we get done talking, I will be very tired.
Mm-hmm.
So. And like you, you made notes, like I kind of work at it, right? Try to get good with it. Some people sit down and it just flows, and that's just not, it's just not how I'm
going. Yeah, I'd just rather be prepared than not. Like to give it its due. Give it its due weight. That's the best way to put it. Like if it's going to matter enough for me to spend an hour doing it, but I should do it well.
For sure. As an introvert, is there a part of that that also just that preparedness makes it easier for you?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's 100%.
They've already said it.
My notes.
Yeah, they've already said it. So it's like, okay. It's not like, and I think, you know, and I've been introduced to a lot of people today because I went over to Nebraska and like, it's like, you know, you have canned responses. It's like, hey, nice to meet you. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's like, say, take care. He's like, no, you just said hi. Like, no, I'm sorry. But yeah, it's just like you say, you know, when somebody says, oh, have a good flight. Well, yeah, you too. It's like, you're not flying. It's like, because it's like, I'm giving a canned response. I'm not being mindful of the actual words that I'm saying.
Right. Oh, exactly.
Because it's more economical for me.
A lot of people do that.
Yeah.
A lot of people do it. They don't even realize they're doing it. Yeah. Chris Bach,
mm-hmm.
when we did his podcast, will be the next one we sort of push out online. And there was some sort of introduction I asked him to do, and he just jumped into his canned response about the NAPL that it gives recruits. And he got done. I was laughing. I was like, okay, that was a spiel. Like, can we break it down?
The recruiting
time. He laughed. And, how you doing on time?
I'm good, actually. Let me just double, because I never changed my...
Oh, all good.
Never changed my watch over, so I'll make sure.
So while you're checking on that, mm-hmm. do you want to try some alert?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I'm kidding.
So particularly... Since you just, I didn't realize you would describe yourself as an introvert. Not that we've had too many conversations. That's awesome.
Yeah. Kids amazing.
9 months?
Yep. Big boy.
Well,
what kind of liqueur?
This is Malort. It's labeled as a Swedish liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that the man from underground would drink because it's bitter.
Yeah.
And so thanks for coming on.
No cheers. Thanks for having me. I'm a big guy. I like IPAs.
More okay.
On the fruity than the bitter side. It's got a familiar sort of aftertaste to it. I can't place it.
Well, the label only says like botanical. Like it doesn't give you a lot. And then it finishes off by saying for two-fisted drinkers, which, of course, we all think is hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
But the reactions, there's actually videos on YouTube.
Grapefruit.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I had grapefruit at breakfast, but.
No, you're onto something because I think I mentioned this in a different conversation I had, maybe with Chris Bach, mm-hmm. but Avery, to sort of ease things back for people, found a cocktail made with this, and it included a grapefruit radler as part of the mixology, and then a bit of a lemon to cut it. And I think it was with Apernol.
Fantastic.
It's pretty good, but no, everyone tends to have a reaction, and that's why we do it, right? So
I like it.
So yeah, the unofficial official drink of elite form. So game tonight.
Mm-hmm.
What time's tip off?
7 o'clock here.
What time will you have to kind of get going with that?
We'll get there about an hour and a half prior. I'll be on the court before then, and I'll have a couple guys that I'll do some individual mobility with. And if a guy wants me to stretch, I'm gonna stretch him. Like, and then start warm up about 55 on the clock. Do like 8-line passing drill as like a general warm up. And then we'll go through like a hip circle series along with RPR wake-up drills. And then we'll do some like a band stretch series. And that'll be it. It takes all about 7 minutes. Again, I try not to get in the way. I remember it would have been probably 2008. No, probably 2010-ish. 2009, maybe, we had a scrimmage against Yale at Stony Brook, and I was warming up the team. We were doing like line drills and foot fires, and like doing a warm up, all the things that they teach you to do in the book,
right?
So to speak. And this is coach's chap comes up and he's like, "Yeah, coach, like, let's cut all that shit out." It's like, "No, you'll be doing foot fires before a game. Just stretch them out." Mm-hmm. And that's it. It's like, hey, gotcha, coach. And so it was, I try and figure out what's the most good I can do and what's the best use of the time that I have that I've been given.
Gotcha.
And try and figure that out. Like our pregame warm-up's a little bit different than our practice warm-up. We'll practice for, we'll do like 15 to 20 minutes of drills, and then we'll stretch. And coach is always like, and like it sort of worked out. Like I told him, I think when I first started like doing a warm-up on a regular basis, I told him, like, I'd rather you like do some, like get them warm. Just like, I don't want to warm them up. I'd rather you take that time to do, you know, your drills and like go through like, you know, half to three quarter speed, like individual type of stuff or positional work. And then I'll do some stretch mobility, whatever. And then you can go, once we get done with that, you can go full speed. And that's worked out really well. And so like we usually lift after practice, but if we don't, we'll do like a, essentially like an A series, like, you know, A march, A switch, three hop, A switch, A skips, you know, running high knees, running butt kicks, and that's what it
is. So as your kind of thoughts about kind of warming up have evolved over the years, mm-hmm. right? So you reference Stony Brook Yale thing up to now. Have you ever, of course I'm going to ask this question, right? Sure. But have you ever put any technology to any of that? Like, have you like looked at heart rate data from those times or anything?
I've looked at the load that uh-huh. we would do. I don't track it anymore because it kind of dilutes down like what the game intensities are. Mm-hmm. So like anymore, I start tracking data when I start the first period before you throw it up for the tip off, because our warm ups are the same. Like, we do the same warm up every time, so there shouldn't be that much variability.
Right.
And we're not doing heart rate because it's another funny story. We play in Vermont. We were up by 20. It was the first. We just got in the heart rate monitors. I wanted to wear them in game because I knew that game data was very important. And there was a detail that I learned after that would have helped me not have a complete catastrophe. But the heart rate pucks started falling off in the middle of the game. And guys were like taking them off and throwing them to the sideline down the middle of the game. We were up by 20. We lost. So that was a tough conversation to have with coach after the game. But, you know, luckily I was probably like about 13, 14 maybe. So I had enough credibility with him that he didn't want to fire me. But he's like, you know, maybe it's not a good idea for us to have him on during games. But then I learned, like, I talked to the guy from Polar. He's like, yeah, well, a lot of people, you know, for contact sports, they tape them on. So that would have been good information to have.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I could put my cap on from the elite form side and effectively be like, well,
yeah, I should have known.
Obviously, it's a different product, but functionally, we want to work in the gym for you. They need to work on the court.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's better, right?
Yeah.
But no one needs to go through that.
No. But it is what it is. But still my job and still use technology. But right. now I know, like one of the things I sort of live by is, like, I don't want coaches to know that they have them on. I want the guys not to know they have them on. And a lot of the guys don't. Like, they know because, although they'll know because I asked for them at the end of the games. A lot of guys, like, the way that we put them on, where we put them on their shorts, they forget that they're on. So I want to be, like, I was offensive lineman, so, you know, we thrive in anonymity. Like, everybody knows that if you're an offensive lineman and people know your name, it's usually because you got a penalty. So, like, I try and be, like, inconspicuous as possible so that they don't know that it's there, that they don't know what's going on, and that it's embedded. So it's like, yeah, we just do it. It's no big deal.
The balance of being ubiquitous for us has been a little bit difficult because sometimes people are like, for a recruiting trip, mm-hmm. hey, we have this cool thing as well. So that's all.
Yeah,
we are a constant work in progress.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Offensive lineman?
Mm-hmm. Although, my playing weight was like 270, 280. A lot of pounds ago.
Well, that would put you on the light side today for sure.
Oh, yeah. And Joe is never a big the guy I played behind, Jeff Harding's a two-time All-American, unbelievable player. Like Joe would get mad at him for getting too heavy. He didn't want him over like 275, 280.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, he played played for the Steelers for a long, for the Lions and the Steelers for a long time at like 312. He says like his off season weight was like 285, 290. He went to 312 for the season. So he was an amazing player.
You get up to that level, you can't be
too bad. No, he was really good. I learned more from him, and just like he was good for a reason. Like he, you know, during spring ball, you know, everybody else is like offensive lineman, right? You take a step, you know, don't get too excited, don't go too hard. Harding's like, give me a look. If you didn't go hard, you got worked. So yeah, there's a reason why he was good.
Makes sense. Well, goes back to your comment about a lot of it's the horses you get in the door. Yeah. And then there's some incremental probably improvements that you can do, but
you gotta recruit well.
That's the big battle. Mm-hmm. That is the big battle. So as much as I might want to think otherwise, right, for our business, right? Yeah. Or your role, if you don't have the horses,
yeah,
it gets a little difficult.
Yeah, just gotta do enough not to develop them, but don't get in the way.
So have you, you obviously you were an athlete, mm-hmm, right? No disrespect to anything you may be doing now, but a football player, and now you're primarily working with basketball and then obviously oversee the rest. Right. So do you ever find the old athlete sort of coming out in you and like how you're thinking about things or just moments in the weight room?
No, I've had that kind of, I don't say beaten out of me, but like I've had like, in terms of like my interaction with my athletes, like I get competitive and like I'm loud on the bench, and like during practice, like I'm competitive, like I'll always be competitive. I think that's why I want to remain in coaching, because like it allows me to get excited. It allows me to like raise my voice and you know, and like try and affect change by saying something and being excited about somebody making a great play. And like, but in terms of like, I don't train, like I train like an old man. And like being the old athlete or being the old Dave has, because maybe, I don't know if I would put it, but like it probably held me back more than it's helped me. So I think like growing from being that athlete,
yeah,
in that mindset, too, because you know, when you're an athlete, you have a different perspective on things. Like, sure, like you never think you're going to get injured. You never think that anything bad is going to happen. You think you're Superman. So, like, you're going to make bad decisions. You're going to do stupid things. You're going to think that you can do whatever you want to do, you know, get away with certain things. And you know, obviously, those types of, you know, mindsets can be problematic. I think it's definitely helped me understand my athletes, because you know, guys make stupid decisions. They're not like they do what you would think is dumb, but if you talk to them, they'll give you perfectly like what they think is sound rationale.
Right.
You know, you like having the experience of like having seen other people act in ways that they're repeating and have things not work out for them. You know, makes you know that that's not a behavior that you would replicate over time and have long term success.
That's a good way to put it.
But yeah, so it's
no. That's so many of the folks we work with were former athletes,
mm-hmm,
and then there's some transitionary period where you're still.
Yeah, like that was me.
Either getting most of it out of your system. Like I still think. Like, there's something that gets held on to.
Oh, yeah.
And it definitely helps you communicate with student-athletes or mm-hmm athletes in general. But how much of that you carry is just always an interesting
yeah
kind of thing to talk about. So, like, obviously I'm not a coach. I'm still hyper-competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have to sort of direct it elsewhere for the most part.
Yeah.
Because there's a bad version of me that can kind of come out.
With yeah, my wife can play cards with me.
Oh.
Too serious. Like
what games?
Gin, anything really. Like I have to just bite my tongue and like, itself. Yeah, sure, whatever, we can play it that way. It's fine. Just like look somewhere else and like, all right. Yeah, she doesn't like. I'm not good at playing cards unless we're playing it to win. Like, I played, like, my brothers and I play cards, and my family plays cards, and, like, it's competitive.
Yeah.
It's like, I cheat, like, do whatever. Like, my, we used to, like, play cards at Christmas, and nobody wanted to sit in front of the window because you could see, like, people would, like, kind of, like, lean back and see a reflection of the cards.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta, you know, breast your cards, as my mom would say. And, you play to win, and, like, we're gonna agree on what the rules are before we start, and we're all gonna follow the rules. If you don't follow the rules, and, like, that's not okay, and, like, you know, like, there's a lot of smack talk, and
that's hysterical.
Like, my younger brother and I used to play the Rummy 500, and we just kept running total. And so I was up on like a couple thousand points or something at one point, because we played like every day, and he was convinced that I could stack the deck, and I could. He was pretty predictable, so I could kind of tell what he was doing. And, like, I also tried to go out as quickly as I could. So he hated that. He was trying to collect points. I was trying to get him with points, because I figured that was points for me, just the
right.
same. But yeah, that's like, I grew up with two brothers, and, like, we're hyper competitive with each other. So
the classic story.
Oh yeah, like, beat the crap out of each other. Like, my brother cut off the tip of my finger when I was a kid.
And, yeah.
My mom used to tell us, like, it's like, she doesn't go to the hospital anymore unless it requires stitches.
Unless blood is gushing out of someone.
Like, well, yeah. We were riding our bikes around this, like, baseball diamond, like, racing. I was trying to pass my brother on the outside. I laid it down and, like, hit my head on his back peg. Came home and, like, blood going down my face and my shirt. Mom got the Betadine out and just, like, scrubbing my house. Crying and, like, squirming. I was like, "So you want to go to the hospital?" I was like, "They'll shave your head." Shut up real quick.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we would have, my brother was way too young for us to be competitive, but there were kids in the neighborhood, and we'd play football, and one lot was too small. And so we'd play in sort of this double front yard situation, two people's front yard, but there was a gravel driveway in the middle of it. And one day I came home just bloody as hell. And it's because I dove for a pass into the gravel.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom just lit me up. Right. And I remember arguing back with her, like, "Well, what did you want me to do? Like, we're losing, blah, 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 blah." You know, she just looks at me like I'm an alien. Like, maybe don't dive into the gravel, dumbass, was basically where she was trying to get me to.
My parents were along the lines of, "Well, if you're going to complain about it, then don't do it." Because if you created the issue, I mean, you put yourself in the situation, so don't do it if you don't want to.
Accountability.
Deal with it. Yeah.
Accountability 101.
Yeah.
That's good shit. In all seriousness, thanks.
Thank you.
That was fun.
Appreciate it. It was great.